Volume. Welcome to the first episode of Access, a four-part series brought to you by Volume and the Health Justice Initiative. My name is Fatima Hassan. This show aims to unpack the true cost of access to healthcare in the context of COVID-19. COVID-19 is an unprecedented public health crisis. In early March, the World Health Organization declared it a global pandemic, and by mid-March, South Africans went into a strict lockdown that has prioritized a scale-up in testing and screening. Our deaths may be just under 300 people as at mid-May, but in other countries, they've dealt with more than 50,000 people dying in each of their countries from COVID-19 within the space of just a few weeks. With infections and deaths increasing globally, the race is on to scale up affordable testing, to find an affordable vaccine, and to find affordable treatment. But given South Africa's own deadly HIV/AIDS pass and the premature suffering and death caused by the lack of timely access to affordable and life-saving medication for people living with HIV/AIDS in South Africa, then we need to understand the issues that will help us to avoid making the same mistakes. The HIV/AIDS crisis and the deaths in South Africa then were preventable, and access to medicines was a key barrier alongside state-sponsored denialism. So will our response to COVID-19 be any different? In today's episode, we discuss medicine access and the barriers that prevent poor and uninsured patients in developing countries from accessing life-saving medicines. We unpack what patents mean for you as a healthcare user or a person who is ill. Many of you may not know, but if a person needs a medicine for a chronic condition, chances are it is being made by a company that has taken out a patent on it, allowing the company to charge a price that it deems reasonable as a reward for its innovation for a period of 20 years or even more without any competition. We look at how this patent regime can enable or block access to life-saving testing, vaccines, and treatment for COVID-19. We also consider why pricing and licensing matter, especially if the public has funded the research that gave rise to the innovation. In this episode, we are joined by three long-standing activists for affordable medicine access, and also my dear friends, Alistair Reel, Tahir Amin, and Greg Gonzalez. Tahir is a lawyer specializing in intellectual property law and patent reform, and is a co-founder and co-director of the organization called IMAC. Els is a veteran public health and access to medicines advocate and specialist who has worked with Medicine Sans Frontières, Open Society Foundations, and other organizations. Greg is a veteran HIV/AIDS activist and now epidemiologist at Yale University School of Public Health, and also a co-founder and co-director of the Global Health Justice Program. We have worked together for many years in strengthening access to medicines for HIV/AIDS in the Global South. It's such a pleasure to have you all join me for this discussion. Welcome. Tahir, so what is intellectual property and what do patents have to do with medicine access?
Intellectual property comprises of things that you've probably heard of, for example, trademarks, which Coca-Cola, which is trademarked. You've got copyright, so when you read a book, it's usually got some copyright protection. And then you have patents, which is where you invent something. It could be a new wheel. It could be medicines. It could be various things that are utilized and manufactured. And those are usually fall into the patent realm. And each of these aspects of intellectual property have periods of protection. When we talk about patents, typically they are given 20 years of exclusivity. So whoever invents something gets 20 years of exclusivity. And that means, as you said, Fatima, it means that nobody else can make that particular thing or manufacture it, sell it, export it. And in the case of pharmaceuticals, that then allows, for example, pharmaceutical companies to charge whatever price they can because they're the only ones who actually make that product. It's largely evolved in the developed countries first. So South Africa has always had intellectual property laws, and particularly patents, and patents on pharmaceutical products, which means actually the end product that's made is patented, whereas India only allowed patents on the process, for example, i.e. how you make the product, not the actual end product, which meant so many more other competitors could make the actual end product in different ways. So this has grown exponentially over the last 40 years. And as a result, we've seen a lot of consolidation of knowledge. And as a result of that, it means that medicine prices have been getting higher and higher because you have a select number of companies that are holding a hoard of patents on products for longer and longer and longer and well beyond the 20-year period. What companies typically do is that when they invent something, they will then try to extract as many different types of patents on that particular product. So it's not just that you get one patent on a product. Usually, as we found in our work, there could be over 100 patents on a particular product, and all deliberately designed to prevent competition from happening.
And of course, the longer a company can hold on to a patent, the more money it can make. And it can keep off competition, because when competition comes in, the prices can drop by up to 80%. Where have we seen that happen?
HIV was a huge moment in the access to medicine as well, which my colleagues can speak better about. But what we're seeing it in everyday drugs. We've seen it in South Africa in relation to cancer drugs. There's been a huge movement in South Africa to try and change the way the patent law works, particularly in terms of bringing more public participation in order to bring better quality into the examination of patents. Because what pharmaceutical companies typically do is they say they're inventing something or use that, what I call a throwaway term, innovation. And essentially, when you really break the science down behind it, it's actually not really new. It's something that already existed in public scientific literature. And so what happens is that this proprietization, where they can get away with it, unless somebody's really doing the rigid checks and balances. And unfortunately, patent officers are under-resourced to really check every patent. I think South Africa doesn't even examine their patents. So when you apply for a patent, you get pretty much a rubber stamp system. It just gets automatically granted.
What about in other countries?
You take the US Patent Office, for example, one of the biggest granters of patents and one of the biggest pushers of the intellectual property system, is it's all about granting as many patents as possible. And the theory goes is that if you grant patents, people will invest. And so therefore, more development happens, more research happens. And there is some truth to that. But the key is the patent system is really about inventions, not really reproprietizing knowledge that already exists. And I think we live in a society where we use these terms like innovation all the time. And, you know, it's my bugbear is that I think we don't even know what innovation is anymore. It's just a buzzword that is used, and policymakers use it, governments use it, say, oh, we want to grow our economy, we want to innovate. But as we do that, particularly in this, what I call what I would call the sort of neoliberal economy, is it ends up in more privatization of knowledge because we're innovating.
So, Els, I think Tyra's made out a good case for why innovation doesn't necessarily translate into two things: competition in the market, but also access for poor people and users of the healthcare system. Can you take us through issues related to pricing and also what governments can do if, in a context of patent protection, they are unable to get a drug company to voluntarily agree to reduce or lower the price of an essential medicine?
I graduated in the 90s as a biomedical researcher. And you know what? When we were doing our research, we were not thinking about patents at all. It was a totally foreign concept. I mean, I grew up in a time where science was really still about freely exchanging what you learn through publications and conferences, etc., and actually building upon the advances of others. It was not about trying to appropriate it, as Tahir was saying, that knowledge, and then trying to commercialize it. Actually, most of public research was done in the public interest for the public good. And it's actually during the 90s that things gradually started to change. But I want to highlight that to say that it doesn't have to be that way. Actually, if you look at the successes of the pharmaceutical industry, the 60s, 70s, 80s were quite successful years in terms of biomedical innovation and new drugs that were developed, etc. That was before all public science became, let's say, privatized and commercialized through the patent systems. And instead of biomedical research for new drugs, for new vaccines, for new diagnostics, being really oriented towards improving health outcomes, improving people's health outcomes, and therefore addressing the most important or urgent health needs of the people wherever they may be, it has become a matter of commercial activity, and where the research priorities were geared towards where there were market opportunities, and market opportunities that came through the fact that for medical innovations and new drugs and vaccines and diagnostics, high prices could be demanded.
And this is because of monopolies, right? And we have gone from health innovation, improving health outcomes, to something that is more about economic growth and GDP.
What you have is that you have a lot of public investments in research all over the world, and including in South Africa. There is quite an active Ministry of Science and Technology that is investing in research efforts to address some of the health problems South Africa is facing with. But it is always seen as a matter of economic activity, where the results of the medical research are being patented, and then only gets their way through the patients if it can be commercialized.
And why, if I may play devil's advocate, is this a problem?
Only health needs that are commercial opportunities are being addressed. And we see we have a whole range of neglected diseases or neglected populations that are, let's say, too poor to provide or to represent a good market for companies whose health needs are generally neglected. And then, of course, if we want to jump immediately to outbreak diseases such as COVID, anything that is an outbreak disease that do not represent a market are generally largely neglected by companies.
So if you are a minister of health or a president and you're dealing with a outbreak of a disease like COVID-19, and there is a company that manages to get a patent on, let's just say, a vaccine, for example, or a treatment for COVID, how would you make sure, in the absence of goodwill of that particular drug company, that you can have as many people get access to that vaccine or treatment?
The government has national authority over which patents they give out or not. A patent is not a God-given right. A patent is a policy tool. So if the company applies in South Africa for a patent, there can be an examination as to whether, yes or no, it is deemed deserved to issue that patent. And it could be because either the science and technology are not really new or innovative, or governments can also decide that certain inventions are too important, for instance, for public health, to issue a patent. So that's the first thing, the question of whether a patent is even granted for a certain invention. If a patent is granted and the company is not willing to issue a voluntary license or allow anyone else to produce that that product at an affordable price, governments have the right to actually use what they say a compulsory license and actually oblige the company to allow other producers, be it in the country or elsewhere, to produce that product and import it in the country.
Craig, I mean, I think you probably have more experience than most people in dealing with the conduct of pharmaceutical companies and governments that were in cahoots with the pharmaceutical industry. Tahir talked about profits over people. Can you maybe unpack that for us in relation to the HIV/AIDS struggle around the world for people to be able to access affordable life-saving medicines?
Hey, Fatima, thanks for having me. So close to 30 years ago, a drug that wasn't very good, but it was something came on the market to fight HIV. It was called AZT, zidovudine. It was a marginally useful drug at best, but it was priced then at what the New York Times called the highest price for a drug ever in the United States. It was $8,000 for a year's course of the drug. And ACT UP New York, which I was a part of, one of its earliest actions was to go after the drug company in several ways. One was to go onto the floor of New York Stock Exchange with fake dollar bills, throw them off the balcony screaming sell welcome, which is the company Burr's Welcome that made the drug. And my colleague Peter Staley took a bunch of power tools and steel plating down to North Carolina and barricaded himself in the office of the CEO. The price dropped precipitously several weeks later. So drug companies have been profiting off of epidemic diseases since the beginning of the epidemic. And, you know, it's no coincidence that Anthony Fauci, who's the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases here in the United States, called remdesivir, the new drug for COVID-19, like AZT was in the 1980s.
That's a fascinating comparison.
For many years, we didn't have very good drugs at all to treat HIV infection. In 1996, there was a breakthrough. And we now had drugs which made HIV a chronic manageable illness. I myself started taking those drugs right around that time. But what people were noticing all over the world was that all this great news that was happening in the United States, in Western Europe, in Australia, Japan, and other places in the global north was not transferring down to other countries who had AIDS epidemics of their own. And there were certain countries like India, Brazil, and Thailand who took matters into their own hands. Brazil and Thailand embarking upon their own antiretroviral therapy programs. You know, Tahir and Els can talk about the details of how they did that in regard to the patent law, but basically they made generic versions of the AIDS drugs that were tens of thousands of dollars in the United States and Europe in order to help treat the millions of patients that were relying on them for these medicines. As you know, the fight came to South Africa, which you and I and a whole bunch of others were involved with. The main goal around these fights was that you needed to force competition. You had to break the patent monopoly in some way of these drugs to make it available to more people.
So maybe, Craig, if you could just take us through the pharmaceutical industry and the lobby that operates both in DC and I think in other parts of the world, and some of the strategies that people living with HIV/AIDS and other social movements have used to try and encourage transparency and to try and encourage different type of conduct from these very pharmaceutical companies that basically determine not just price, but whether also patients will be able to live or whether they'll be able to die.
So the pharmaceutical industry has the largest lobby in Washington, D.C. in the United States. So our own homegrown attempts to manage drug prices here in the United States has been a failed effort year after year after year because, frankly, too many people are on the take from pharma on Capitol Hill and in our executive branch in the White House to get the companies to make legislative concessions to make drugs more affordable. This hasn't stopped activists. As I said, in the late 80s, activists were taking direct action to force the hand of Burr's Welcome and the price of AZT. And the same sort of strategies of direct action and protest lasted throughout the first generation of antiretrovirals or nucleoside analogs with protest, you know, week after week, month after month as new drugs came online. I think it became a global protest movement post-1996 when we had drugs that were really game changers in the fight against AIDS. And the Treatment Action Campaign in your own country, South Africa, Grupo Pela Vida in Brazil, the the Thai Treatment Action Group and the Thai Drug Users Network in Thailand, but there's been an explosion in activism around HIV, which is really about access to medicines. Because we've also had help from scientists like Andrew Hill and others who have helped us understand how much these drugs cost to make. Many of these drugs are not super expensive to manufacture, and the markup on them is considerable. And it just, you know, I think the main point to also understand here, it's not just about HIV, it's about hepatitis C. It's about a whole range of drugs in which the companies are pricing drugs at the point to which the market will bear it rather than what the rational or the fair price for it is.
Tyre, if we could turn to you, could you take us through two very different issues? The one is the role of public funding and university support in the development of drugs. And then secondly, you know, could you take us through the current developments around Gilead in relation to COVID-19?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's been some fantastic work done by a number of academics, and Els herself has done some stuff on this, as have others, on really exposing the extent of government funding that goes into a lot of products we see on the market today that are sold as private goods by the industry. Now, the US is a huge funder, the National Institutes of Health, of a lot of research. I think they spend up to $40 billion towards a lot of R&D. And usually what happens is governments generally fund a lot of what we call in science speak basic research, which is like the initial sort of breaking the research. And then what happens typically is then they may enter into some kind of public-private partnership, or what has evolved over the last 40 years, at least in the United States, and I think this has started to spread in other countries, is we had the creation of was a particular act called the Bayh-Dole Act, which was allowing universities to basically get government funding. And universities essentially were doing this research with government funding and essentially became sort of economic engines. And it goes back to Els's point about economic growth. A lot of the science industry has become about economic growth rather than actually just real solid, you know, sort of research, pure research. And universities then spin off into companies. And then with that money, a lot of scientists then become billionaires.
Can you give us an example of this?
A lot of the work for the new hepatitis C drugs that started out costing thousands and thousands of dollars were actually spun out of a lot of initial research from universities with public funding. And what happens is that we've ended up with a system where universities were used to be the centers of pure knowledge and research that was available as public good has largely been privatized. And this has caused, and then pharmaceutical companies have associated themselves with these universities and essentially brought them into their kind of way of thinking. And so we now have a system which is entirely co-opted by private interests, but paid for by public funding. And we are seeing this in not only in COVID now, but this has been going on for a number of years. I mean, just take a drug like Lyrica, which is a Pfizer drug, and it's for pain relief, nerve and muscle pain. That was started at as a research at Northwestern University. And it was, I think there was an NIH grant of about $680,000. It led to the compound, which was then used in the end product Lyrica. The Northwestern University then had a license agreement with Pfizer, and Pfizer would pay them royalties on that drug. But at that point, all the power rested in Pfizer in terms of what it did with the product. And it's interesting to see that the amount of royalties that Pfizer paid back to Northwestern actually covered an entire endowment for a year for Northwestern University.
So the universities have bought into this, and as a result, they may potentially make some profit?
Some may argue that's great. You know, it's growing the economy. It's making other people wealthy. But ultimately, it's done on the back of public taxpayer dollars. And when we look at what's happened with Gilead now, with the remdesivir, which is the only current treatment we have, we don't even know how really effective it is. That was supposedly funded by various estimates, and we don't even have full transparency. At least $80 million from NIH funding, that's public funding. And yet Gilead now has full control of that. And if you look at the development of that product, it started back when there was the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. And most of the initial research was actually done with U.S. military funding. And then further research was done on the various respiratory diseases, SARS, which were kind of a coronavirus too, MERS. And that was all done collaboratively with universities, but with public funding. And so you have to ask the question, what was Gilead doing, sort of in the meantime? It wasn't really investing its own dollars other than actually waiting for results from universities that had received NIH funding. And then all of a sudden we have this pandemic outbreak, and now Gilead's all of a sudden interested and potentially could profit out of this moment, even though it's saying it's donating sort of all the doses that it has at the moment. But if this becomes a standard treatment down the road, and we all, I think for those of us who work in health, understand that this coronavirus is not going away. Until a vaccine arrives, Gilead could stand to make a significant amount of money. And despite it licensing to a number of developing countries, they stand to hold the richer markets for themselves. And I think there's a fundamentally broken system where, you know, people talk about free markets. There is really no such thing as a free market. It's this illusion that there's no state intervention. And it's the biggest con, if you want to ask me, that has ever been played in on the public. The idea that you have these folk who sort of defenders of the free market, because we saw that, we're seeing that in COVID all over. All of a sudden, you know, the free market is going to save us. But there's billions of dollars being pumped into these companies to develop a number of COVID treatments. What were they doing before that? And so I think these are the questions we really need to ask of our economic systems, and who gets the gains and who gets the benefits and who gets to set the prices. I think I'm not going to entirely blame the pharmaceutical companies. I think they are the symptom of the actual cause, and the cause is the economic system that we've been driving for the last 40 years. Mm. I think for a long time, you know, it's been a, you know, we have to challenge the players. The players also help create the system. But if you look at the incentives that get set, they're set by governments. They're set by a economic agenda, and particularly the Western countries, because they want to keep, you know, hegemony. They want to keep power. They want to keep control, and it's all about resources. And so it's going to be interesting to see what happens in this moment with the COVID, because let's say, for example, China comes up with a vaccine first. What's going to happen then? And so, you know, the US has been the ultimate promoter of the current agenda. And it continues to do so, and it's actually pushed an agenda that China has now adopted. So now in reverse, China might do the same. So we really have to look at the origins of all this, and what have we been driving towards, and have we really sort of got to the edge of the cliff and about to drive ourselves off it? Or are we going to rescue ourselves and turn back?
So wait, let me get this clear. In the middle of a global pandemic that is considered to be unprecedented, Gilead still has the authority and control to decide who gets licenses, who doesn't get licenses, and whether they will give up full exclusivity or not.
Yes, unless the U.S. government or any other government steps in, as Els mentioned, you know, and issues what we call a compulsory license, which every national government has the right to do. They can actually override any patent right and say, you know what, we're going to allow others to produce this particular product because it's in the national interest. It's a public emergency, and you will get a reasonable, you know, royalty, whatever that is. The governments have to intervene. It's not just going to happen at this moment in time. Gilead is controlling, or, you know, has control of all the strings. And essentially, when you think about it, as Els mentioned with voluntary licenses, they are essentially that. They're just voluntary. And we've seen that in the HIV space, in the hepatitis C space, is that Gilead has become very artful in managing the competition. It knows where to slice the pie because it knows where its profits lie. It knows where it can actually maximize.
So, Els, if I could ask you to explain to us what is supposed to be the role of the World Trade Organization and the current developments there, because in the absence of a functional WTO, Maybe explain to our listeners where governments or the public or patients can actually turn to.
Maybe I'm too optimistic, but if you listen to the discourse today of, you know, governments who've always, as was explained by Tahir and Greg, been very much sided with corporate interests for a variety of reasons, including because there was a lot of lobby money being thrown at them, in particular in the US. Things are changing. I mean, I have been baffled by the discourse that we've been hearing from, you know, world leaders in Germany, in France, in Canada, in New Zealand, for that matter. But of course, and where we have different dynamics going on, and again, we're talking power dynamics. Already, in fact, last year with the World Health Assembly, it's exactly a year ago. There was a very interesting change and shift in the power dynamics where you had a number of countries from different continents, not the usual suspects, where it was developing countries trying to make progress on affordable access to medicines, but there was a transparency resolution demanding transparency on the cost structure, the pricing, also on clinical trial data, on patents, etc. And it was a coalition of countries with a few European countries and a few African countries, Latin American countries, Asian countries, that all kind of came together around the need for a dramatic reform of the way in which we actually negotiate with pharma. Because if you do not have the data about how much money has actually been invested, how is a price actually being constructed, what is a fair price for that matter, if you don't have even access to the data that are supposedly showing the safety and efficacy of the products that are being marketed, all of that, it puts governments at a very weak position. It's like they are blindfolded and with their hands tied with the, behind their back when they are negotiating with pharma. And so that transparency resolution of last year was a very important, I think, transgressive step. But in particular, because it was not the developing countries against the wealthy countries who sided with our pharmaceutical industry. No, it was a mix because the problem of affordable access had already become global. Now, if we listen to the discourse in COVID, I mean, you have developed wealthy countries talking about the vaccine needs to be available as a global public good. We've never heard that language before coming from wealthy governments.
And I think that's such an important point that there is an unprecedented demand coming from leaders in the European Union that we have never seen before, particularly in relation to the drug company called Sanofi, which is linked to the potential vaccine development.
What we're hearing now is that, you know, there's 90 vaccines in development for COVID-19. It's unprecedented sort of rush to develop these new tools, but everybody knows that even if we are successful in finding a vaccine, which is a big if, remember, we don't have an HIV vaccine 40 years later, the question of access is going to be incredibly acute for all over the world. And I think this is why you're hearing sort of broad talk about the people's vaccine and access, because it's going to be a global phenomenon. There's not going to be enough to go around anywhere on the planet. And we're going to have to figure out new ways of making access an international phenomenon rather than think about these things in the context of global inequities, but think about it as a sort of revisioning of how we think about essential medical products the world over.
I agree completely with Greg. The question is who gets it first? And obviously, we're already seeing countries using the nationalist rhetoric to protect their own first and not make it a sort of a global effort. We've seen some great collaboration that's gone on in more than ever amongst even companies. The question really that's going to be what we're all looking for is whether companies are going to actually make this available not to the highest bidder, but to humanist principles. I think that's something that we have to watch out for, because inevitably we've already seen that with the personal protective equipment, where shipments were being sort of siphoned off and diverted to other places because of highest bidders. Is that going to happen with vaccines?
So Sanofi, the company, has been in the news recently. Els, could you share with our listeners why that is?
But so Sanofi, typically seen as a French company, who has made a deal with the U.S. Government. I think it was BARDA, who has been, making agreements and pretty big investments with a number of vaccine companies, and where then suddenly the word got out that meant that actually Sanofi would, if their vaccine would be successful, and there is a lot of ifs there, there's a lot of hubris about all the companies saying that they will have a vaccine available anytime soon, but if the Sanofi would have a vaccine, that would mean that their first supply would be to the US, and of course Sanofi, who has always been benefiting from a lot of support from the French government. The French were not amused, to say that lightly. And so there's been a lot of back and forth, probably a lot behind the scenes, to conclude now that Sanofi has admitted, the last I read about it, or has committed to offer the first 30 million vaccines to France, and the next 70 million to the US and the world, or some vague statement. Now, as Tahir pointed out, I mean, this whole allocation of vaccines to the highest bidder will, if this is how things will play out, it will be extremely ugly.
I mean, the only thing I would add is that COVID-19 has exposed the weakness in our sort of profit-driven, monopoly-dominated health system. And it's not just about the pills and the drugs. It's about the vaccines. And as Els has said, it's about the diagnostics, but it's about things as simple and sort of forgettable as vials for collecting patient samples, about the long-stemmed Q-tips or cotton swabs that we use to retrieve nasopharyngeal samples. It's all sort of controlled by these single companies, whether it's in the United States or Italy or other places around the world, and it's untenable in the context of a global health crisis. I think what we don't understand is that these crises happen on a day-to-day basis in local communities in South Africa, where access to these basic medical supplies, let alone the COVID vaccine when it comes out, unreachable for them on a daily basis.
Thank you so much, Els, Tahir, Greg. I really appreciate it. It's been absolutely fascinating getting your input and listening to your expert views. The most important issues that you've highlighted for us in this unprecedented global crisis is solidarity, human empathy, and the ability of the public and civil society to keep vested interests and the pharmaceutical monopolies, as well as our own government, to account, by insisting on transparency and full disclosure. Thank you for joining us on Access. Remember to follow us on Twitter at Health Justice Inn. I'm Fatima Hassan, and remember to tune in next week for episode 2. This episode was brought to you by Volume. Goodbye. Volume.